From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Today, Rebecca Cruz and I focus on the dozens of nations involved in the search for Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 and why it's difficult for countries to cooperate during international tragedies.
This is a region of the world that hasn't always had very good relations. You know, the South China Sea, where much of the initial searching was going on, there's a number of islands that are contended upon there.
And later, Rebecca talks with Baylor University political scientist Serhii Kudylia about the ouster of Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych.
He did not take into account the diversity of Ukraine, both regionally and the strength of the civil society that he had to face, something that Russia did not have when Putin was building up his political system.
What comes next in Ukraine after these news headlines? This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, everyone has been fixated for the past couple of weeks on this missing Malaysian airliner, Flight 370, the flight that took off from Kuala Lumpur en route to Beijing and somehow redirected for whatever reason and then went missing. So the search continues. So many questions. Who knows when or if we'll ever get any answers. But the interesting thing here is that we have a number of countries, about 20 countries or more, involved in the actual search process, trying to determine where this plane went down or what happened to it, basically. And so there's a lot of speculation, clearly, about what might have happened, what did happen, whether there's debris or not debris. But, you know, the international politics of the search process is an interesting kind of an additional thing to watch during this process. So first, we'll start with Malaysia and China and the relationship between the two. Clearly, you have a plane full of Chinese nationals traveling to China. There's a very tense relationship now. The Chinese are very upset with the Malaysians. The Chinese family is obviously very upset with the Malaysians and more or less suggesting that they're incompetent. They couldn't control their airspace. They can't manage the investigation. So what are we to expect from this in terms of the long-term relationship between these two countries?
Well, obviously, the Malaysian government has come out and countered that, saying that they are doing everything that they can. And, of course, China has a lot of families to answer to. There have also been complaints within China from many of these families that the Chinese government has not been as forthcoming as they could be. And, of course, we all remember from the first week that there was some information that came out from China that was very inaccurate. So there seems to be a little bit of a misinformation on both sides and frustration mounting. Obviously, the families in particular are very, very frustrated. But what I think is so remarkable here is we do have over 20 countries, you mentioned, that at least have some fairly good intentions. There seems to be some international cooperation on this, seems to be countries getting involved. And we're talking about a very, very large space that this plane could have gone down in. So there are a lot of people, a lot of technologies involved, and it's going to take a little bit of coordinating.
Well, certainly the Chinese families are now even threatening hunger strikes. So it will be very interesting to see how that emerges in terms of how the Chinese and the Malaysians work out this situation. But you mentioned international cooperation. There's a lot of cooperation, but there's also a lack of cooperation in some cases. I mean, look at what Indonesia did this week. The search planes actually had to they were grounded for a day and lost precious time in terms of their searching because once the search area had been shifted due to new data, as they're gathering data every minute, the Indonesians refused to allow these planes to fly through their airspace in order to access that southern part of the Indian Ocean, saying that that the international bureaucratic procedures hadn't been followed, that the paperwork for such overflights hadn't been filed. So, I mean, what on earth would motivate Indonesia to somehow get in the way of this international cooperative effort to find this airplane?
Well, it's tough to say exactly what's motivating them. But of course, while we are seeing a lot of good intentions, perhaps we are also seeing politics. This is a region of the world that hasn't always had very good relations. You know, the South China Sea, where much of the initial searching was going on, there's a number of islands that are contended upon there from various countries. So Indonesia is trying to perhaps protect its own sovereignty and its own position. Now, we think of this region of the world, there are some trade relations there. There is some cooperation going on, ASEAN, APEC. OPEC, the Pacific countries that have economic trading blocs. But that is not necessarily helping in this regard. There are some relationships, but there is no set way for them to figure out how to do a search and rescue, who will take responsibility, and who will move forward on this. So lots of little inner political games going on while at the same time trying to figure out where this missing plane is.
Yeah, the dynamics are really incredible. I mean, if you look at the overall international effort here, I mean, if you look at who's in charge, right? I mean, the question of who is appointed, who comes out as the person that's really supposed to take charge here, because there's so many different voices, a lot of different cultures and languages to navigate here, a lot of different eyewitness accounts, everything from Thailand and everywhere around. So, you know, you've got all of these different voices. And so who's supposed to coordinate this? Well, there is no international body that's responsible for this sort of thing, an international airline tragedy. There is an international civil aviation organization, a special agency of the United Nations that helps produce principles and protocols, you know, for safe air travel and air navigation, but they aren't in charge of, they don't have any power. They're not, it's not like they're in charge of these types of investigations. So the investigator in charge becomes the country or the government from which this airliner has originated. So Malaysia, the Malaysian government is in charge. You know, much like if such a tragedy happened in the United States with a U.S. airplane, then the National Transportation Safety Board would be in charge. But then they then have the very difficult task of coordinating all of these different voices and gathering all of this data. And clearly the cooperation then may turn, I suppose, to a lack of cooperation because of the challenges.
Well, think about how much data is having to be collected and over the expanse that it's having to be collected. The Indian Ocean, of course, is very, very large. The area where this may have gone down is there's not a lot of people there. There's not a lot of technology there. And also a number of the countries here, we're talking about capabilities. You know, China and the United States, they may have the technological capabilities. Some of these other countries may not. So that further complicates the search.
Well, as I mentioned, so many questions and right now a lot of different types of answers, but definitely a tragedy that we will continue to watch for the coming days. Thank you so much, Rebecca Cruz, as always. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this program or answer any questions you may have. We're on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzette Gorlott and at Cruz226. You can also leave a comment on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org. Next, Rebecca talks with Baylor University political scientist Serhiy Khodylia about Ukraine's future after last month's ouster of President Viktor Yanukovych. I'm Suzette Gorlott, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Once the dust settles in Eastern Europe and the dispute over Crimea moves off the front pages of international media, Ukraine still faces a long road toward political and economic stability. Our guest, Serhiy Khodylia, is a political scientist at Baylor University. In a recent piece for the magazine Foreign Affairs, he writes that Ukraine has a parasitic, interconnected political class, which is very good at using populism and predation to prosper. You can read that article on our website, kgou.org. Khodylia spoke with Worldviews contributor Rebecca Cruz and University of Oklahoma political scientist Paul Good, who focuses on nationalism and ethnic politics in post-Soviet regions.
Paul Good and Serhiy Khodylia, welcome to the show and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're back here to talk about the situation in Ukraine. Obviously, this is something that we've been following now since November. It seems to be an evolving situation. And I was wondering, Serhiy, how are we to think about what happened in February in Ukraine? This overthrow of Yanukovych, removal from office, is this something that we might classify, and certainly the media has classified, as a revolution? Doesn't quite sound like what an academic would call a revolution, or the Eastern media has called this a coup. Or was this a constitutional protest that removed an authoritarian leader? How should we be thinking about this?
Well, I think we should start, first of all, discussing the origins of that movement, because it started basically as a protest against a certain policy. It was very policy-oriented. It was just a bunch of people who expected Yanukovych and the Ukrainian government to sign an association agreement with the European Union and to move forward with the European integration, something that the president has promised for a long time, for his entire presidency. And this initial impetus, which was a policy-oriented impetus, basically transformed into a more revolutionary movement. And as a result, we saw the toppling of the president and the coming in of the opposition, which some may correctly characterize it as a revolution, primarily because it involved a large number of people on the streets. The coup usually is done by the people on the inside. It involves a smaller group of people who are overthrowing a particular person through a palace coup or palace intrigue. Here we really had, it was a genuinely grassroots movement that included not just the opposition leaders or members of political parties, but really broader social segments of the society.
And there's been a lot of comparison of this, obviously, to the Orange Revolution.
Yes.
But you've written that these are quite different, that these protests actually looked more like historical protests from the past. Is that correct?
Well, my point was that, in a way, the difference between Ukraine and Russia was that Yanukovych tried to build a very centralized authoritarian system that would be similar to Putin's system. And he did not take into account the diversity of Ukraine, both regionally and the strength of the civil society that he had to face, something that Russia did not have when Putin was building up his political system.
So here I'd like to ask, the composition of the protesters has been a really crucial aspect of the arguments over whether or not the new government in Kyiv is legitimate. And particularly the Russian narrative has really emphasized the role of what it calls Benderites, ultra-nationalists, fascists. To what extent were those elements really present and what kind of role did they play? And should the West really be paying attention to that as Kyiv moves towards trying to secure a legitimate new government?
Right. Well, definitely the presence of nationalists was more prominent and visible during the last wave of protests compared to the Orange Revolution. There was a clear usage of the historical figures that were associated with the nationalist movement in the 1930s and 1940s against the Soviets, against the Soviet Union. And one can say that the strength of the commitment of the nationalist groups within that movement helped to sustain it over a longer period of time. Most of the people who were camped out on the streets, many of them, I shouldn't say most, but many of them were hardcore nationalists. But I would not say or agree with the Russian characterization of the movement as dominated by the nationalists. Again, as I said, it had a wide variety of groups that were involved in it. They organized self-defense units, which were the sort of paramilitary groups that were primarily initially created to defend themselves from the attacks from the riot police. And there were some nationalist paramilitary groups, but many of them were groups that represented different segments of the society. And I have some polls that show that basically the anti-Russian feelings, anti-Russian sentiments of nationalists was shared by no more than 20% of the entire protest movement. It was primarily movement against repressive actions of the authorities, against what some people saw excessive use of force, but not necessarily against Russia. On your second question, whether they should be concerned, yes, absolutely. And I think one of the mistakes of the new authorities was to include so many representatives of the nationalist far-right party Svoboda in the new government, particularly giving them positions like the prosecutor general or the defense minister, something that will generate some fears on the part of the ethnic Russians, both in Crimea and in other parts of Ukraine. So I thought this was a mistake, and I think if the West has the possibility to communicate certain policy advice to the new government, it should communicate that idea that if you were to include nationalists, you should give them positions like the agriculture minister, maybe, or something that has to do with roads, but not something that has to do with the use of force.
Political scientist Serhii Kodylia, speaking with Worldviews contributor Rebecca Cruz and University of Oklahoma political scientist Paul Good. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. let's get back to our conversation with Baylor University political scientist Serhiy Kudylia, who's talking about the future of Ukraine with Worldviews contributor Rebecca Cruz and University of Oklahoma political scientist Paul Good.
What comes next? How to keep the forward momentum going? What can Ukraine do?
Well, first of all, of course, they already faced, once they moved in, once they came into power, they were already faced with very difficult legacies from the previous regime. One of them is the economic legacy, the fact that the country is essentially bankrupt. Many of the money that has been given to Ukraine over the years or loaned to Ukraine were embezzled, stolen. And we need substantial funds to pay off the debts that we already accumulated, in addition to fulfilling of the basic functions of the state. The second challenge has to do with the external threat coming from Russia and the possibility of continued destabilization that will diffuse from Crimea to other parts of Ukraine. In addition to that, there are just basic questions of enhancing the state capacity and rebuilding the institutions of the state, because the basic institutions like the court system, for example, the law enforcement, they have been destroyed by the previous regime because they have been excessively politicized, they have been misused and abused by the current authorities, and the public in general does not have trust in these institutions. So these are huge challenges that the new governments face, and the problem is that not only they don't have resources to address these problems, both intellectual resources and financial, but also they don't have enough legitimacy. We see that the key issue that President Putin has been stressing, the poor legitimacy of the current authorities, essentially in some respects he is right, because the acting president, who replaced Yanukovych, has been put in his place through very dubious formal procedures. It's only the government and the prime minister who are, I would say, more or less legitimate. And that's one of the reasons why President Obama agreed to meet with the Ukrainian prime minister in Washington. And these are the sort of the three most important challenges that they have to deal with. And I don't think that without substantial Western backing, both from the European Union and the United States, I don't think they will be able to address these challenges adequately.
You know, one of the legacies of the previous regime might be considered even the current operating parliament, insofar as it was elected under the previous system prior to the constitutional changes that were adopted following Yanukovych being ejected from power. Why do you think that it is that there hasn't been more of a push for new parliamentary elections as well as new presidential elections?
Excellent question. I personally favor both early presidential and parliamentary elections. I think the vested interests of members of parliament, who realize that many of them may not be reelected if there is a new parliamentary election, that's something that prevents them from moving forward. It's all both the opposition. Some of the opposition parties realize that they may lose a substantial number of support because there are new political actors that emerged during this protest, both youth groups and some more nationalistic parties than the existing far-right parties. So there is a lot of competition for the former opposition. And the Party of Regions, the ruling party, obviously lost a lot of support as a result of this protest. So all of the key political actors who can decide on staging new parliamentary elections are actually not interested in them.
Well, thinking about, again, moving forward, I think one of the criticisms perhaps of the United States and the Western world is that we have tried to advance democracy very much in our own image and what that democracy is going to look like. So I'm just curious, can and should Ukraine end up in a situation that looks very Western, or is Ukrainian democracy going to be something unique, and what might that look like?
I'm always wary about the characterizations of democracy as unique, because once you say we have our own unique version of democracy, that always reminds me of a more of an Orwellian take on democracy than anything else. I hope we would just follow the standard path. Obviously, we would need to design our institutions more in correspondence with the ethnic composition of the state itself. That's something that has been ignored, I think, by the previous designers, the fact that given how polarized the country is, concentrating too many powers in the presidency is a wrong idea, because it creates a very tough political competition, very intense political competition, then leads to half of the country feeling cheated. I think that the more parliamentary system would be better for Ukraine, and a different kind of a election system as well, not majoritarian but a more proportional representation system. But in general, I think the European path for Ukraine, in line with Poland, in line with other Eastern European countries, is something that we can hope to achieve realistically, not necessarily in the near future, but maybe in the next 10 years.
Some have suggested that in Ukraine what is needed right now is not so much reconstitution of central state authority as it is a decentralization of power, if not possibly federalization of Ukraine. Many people in Ukraine are steadfastly opposed to this, especially under the current circumstances. What's your take on this? Would Ukraine benefit from federalization, or is it actually potentially a threat to Ukrainian statehood?
Well, I personally favor federalization. Of course, if you many people define federalization differently. I think one of the mistakes of the new authorities was the rejection of any attempt to try to negotiate a new deal, a new relationship with Crimea. Once they came in, they should have made it clear that they were willing to give them greater autonomy, control over their budgetary resources, a greater influence for their parliament, which has so far been a rubber stamp institution for Kiev, really did not have much powers, and an opportunity to elect their own leader in the form of prime minister. I think in general, federalization, if we mean giving greater control over financial resources and self-rule for the localities in Ukraine, is a good idea. Of course, it presents a lot of risks if on the national level you continue to impose a certain set of preferences that would diverge from the preferences of certain parts of the country. So in other words, if you on the national level pursue a very nationalistic policy without taking into account the mainstream, the middle voter, if you want, of the country, then, of course, that will alienate substantial parts of the population. And under the federal structure, this will create pressure or incentives for other regions to secede. So, in other words, federalization requires a consensus on the national level about what these common policies should be for the future. But in general, yes, I agree, it's a good idea for Ukraine.
Well, certainly much to consider. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz and Paul Good's conversation with Ukraine scholar Serhii Kudylia. We have more information on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Nick Aguilera serves as our digital content intern, and Brian Hardzinski produces the show. For Rebecca Cruz and Paul Good, I'm Suzette Gorlott.